Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Here we go. How you doing, James?
I'm doing all right. So, you know what I wanted to do today?
What's that?
I wanted to just sort of talk a little bit about the sort of things that a gravitational theory has to do, what it has to match up with in order to be considered a reasonable gravitational theory. So last time we were talking about these FR theories of gravity, which add something to the action in the gravitational thing. They add something to the gravitation that is nonlinear in the Ricci scalar, right? And when we were talking about these, we talked a little bit about how tests work with this. Not very much, because we were thinking about doing this. So we talked about these theories both last time with the FR theories of gravity, and we talked about them also, some of these things we talked about when we were talking about the G4B. So it would be nice just to get an idea about what all of these things are. Now, some of these I already knew about, right? We're going to talk about things like in the weak field limits. And these are things that we've already talked about a little bit with the G4B. Like, you know, we have to reproduce Newtonian mechanics. We have to be able to look at the perihelion of Mercury and get light bending and all those other things that we've actually seen happen. But now that we have a lot of cosmological data, people have extra things that they want to look at. And because people have a lot of experience mathematically with this, they also have certain theoretical problems that show up over and over when you're trying to make these new theories that you have to avoid. And so I'd like to talk about those things today, and I think you're a good person to talk about this with, because I think you have a lot broader knowledge on this than I do. So do you think you're up to that?
Yeah, let's do it. I guess we could look at this as the parameters of alternative gravity theories.
I'm glad you already have a title.
I just came up with that.
That's right. So the first thing I'd like to talk about with these things are the sort of cosmological things. And the reason why I'd want to talk about those is this is the reason why people care about alternative theories of gravity, is because we have these issues with, you know, the cosmic microwave background and other things like that, where things aren't exactly the way people thought they would be, just looking at general relativity. And so people are trying different avenues to match that data. Obviously, there's dark matter and dark energy, but like we talked about last time, one of the nice things about these FR theories is a lot of times these FR theories have a physical idea behind them that match either the dark matter or the dark energy. And a lot of these other alternative theories of gravity similarly have a real physical idea rather than, you know, we've looked at this stuff and if we match these things, it seems like it should be that way.
Now, one of the things that FR gravity theories could do that I wasn't even aware any theory could do was that not only could it introduce a late-term acceleration that looks like dark energy, but some of them could also offer an early cosmic inflation epoch, which is currently a real stumbling block for modern cosmology, because we have to postulate the existence of a whole new particle called the inflaton in order to explain, well, how did the early universe expand so rapidly if its density was so high? You'd think that gravitationally it would want to collapse back in on itself. So something like FR gravity gives you a mathematics that says, hey, you know, this is built into these theories. So that's one of the exciting motivations that I saw in there.
Yeah, I'd really like to get some idea about what these things are that we have to match or that people are trying to match. So it's kind of interesting, since people are trying to match these cosmological ideas, the really good tests of these theories becomes, after we've matched these cosmological ideas, what about these old things that we already knew about? So that's actually kind of nice that, you know, they still have to go back and try to match the older weak field limits. But again, I'd like to try to get some idea about these cosmological things before we go on. And I think there are two things cosmologically that we were looking at in this paper, which was on FR theories in particular. One of those were the cosmological dynamics, and the other were the cosmological perturbations, evolution in response to cosmological perturbations. What did you really understand as cosmological dynamics?
Yeah, I think of it as the overarching picture of cosmic evolution, right? Where, you know, how do you get from that first moment of the Big Bang to the universe that we see today and all of the observations that we see in between? Because that's a fairly complicated pattern to mimic. I mean, you've got to have a period that's very hot. We know that, very hot in the beginning, that doesn't have any baryonic matter at all. And then it's got to get to the transparency point where the cosmic microwave background radiation appeared. And that has to happen at a certain rate. So you've got to have, you know, a certain energy within the universe at that time to drive that really rapid expansion. And then there's a very sudden deceleration once baryonic matter appears, and there's this deceleration that goes on, and only very slowly in fairly recent cosmic history, I guess it's probably what, the last quarter or a third of cosmic history, you start to see the emergence of dark energy forces driving an acceleration. So all of that, plus the structure of the universe and all that, seems like, you know, part of the cosmological dynamics that you want to get out of a gravitational theory, and that's, it's a difficult picture to predict.
Okay, yeah, and did you get any idea here about how FR theories worked with those? Because I kind of didn't get a great idea about how they in particular work with these.
Well, I know that the additional scalar field, which is introduced by FR theories, gives you some really fascinating scale dynamics, and so you can have a situation where you've got a really high density distribution of matter, and you can have an extremely high energy scalar field driving a rapid expansion that would fit really nicely with the cosmic inflation period. But then, on the other end of it, you've got a residual field that becomes dominant when matter drops below a certain density in the universe that you can observe as dark energy. So, just in basic terms, that's the sense that I got out of it. And I don't know if this ties in with the chameleon mechanism they talked about, where at the small scale, this scalar field has a really high mass energy density, and at a larger scale, it has a very low energy density.
Yeah, I think there's something like that. The scalar field has to, in some way, be scale dependent. And I believe this is actually something that comes about from trying to keep dark energy around. I think the chameleon mechanism is actually something that they borrowed from dark energy. Yeah, so they brought this in from the idea of dark energy. And it helps to mask some of the problems with cosmological dynamics, I think.
Yeah, the quintessence model of dark energy is where they found this chameleon mechanism, right?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a mechanism. I think it's something that they have to postulate to make it work. So it's not something that they've seen. I think it's something that if you want...
Oh, you can define the scalar field to have a large effective mass in the short range and a low effective mass in the long range. You just define it that way and put it into the equation and get the universe that we see. Is that it?
It's something like that, yeah. So I think it's one of these things that is a patch on top of a patch. I think in the FR theories, they get that for free. I'm not completely sure, but that's what it sounded like to me when reading this paper, is that they got a mechanism that looked like that chameleon mechanism for free out of the theory.
Yeah, they got that out of the metric FR theories, right?
And so that's good. Well, I mean, it's good that they're getting something that looks like the thing that was supposed to be a patch to another theory. I mean, that looks good. I mean, not everything for the FR theories looks good, but a lot of places it actually looks like, even though this is more or less a toy theory, mainly because you have so much leeway to play with it, you are seeing from these theories fixes to the problems that have some physical basis based on the thing that you're toying with, which makes that whole idea of it being part of a physical basis. I mean, ideally, you wouldn't just choose this form of this equation randomly. It's not really random the way they do it, but it's close enough.
Yeah, there's not really a theoretical motivation for it. It's more of like a retroactive patch approach.
Well, that's how it began, right? So when Hilbert first did something that could be now described as an FR theory, he was just playing around with it. From reading this, it sounds like they do have a lot of ideas about this thing. They have, from playing around with the FR theories, a lot of ideas about what has to happen to make one of these things work. That can probably be brought back into other more physically motivated gravitational theories later on.
Yeah, this sort of checklist of items that a gravitational theory would have to meet in order to be credible and exciting, it's probably the most clearly beneficial result from doing this kind of work. It really helps you, you know, understand what you need out of a theory. I'm not so sure that I'm convinced that taking a theory like general relativity and then modifying it to make it emulate the newer observations is really that great of a way to go in terms of advancing physics, but what it does do is it gives you the sort of list of principles that a theory needs to meet. In that sense, I think it's really valuable.
I think the FR theories, going through all of these different situations that we're talking about, it really does help us understand gravity more. Again, that's exactly why Hilbert started the whole thing off. That was his sort of mathematician's idea of how to explore something, is change a parameter, take something that's linear, turn it into a quadratic thing, see what happens, right? I mean, that's exactly what a mathematician would do. And there are a lot of benefits for exploring things that way.
Right.
So what did you understand about Big Bang nucleosynthesis? So what I understood about it just happening is that at some point the radiation pressure drops to a point where the photons are no longer interacting with each other, but there's still enough of it so that they're basically putting these atoms together.
Frankly, I'm not entirely sure how baryonic matter condenses out of the fireball of the Big Bang. I guess it's just a matter of there's enough energy density in space-time that part pair production is happening, and that for some reason that's a little bit asymmetrical, so we get the baryon rather than anti-baryon domination.
This was something I was reading about in another book, Gravity by Bernard Schutz, or Bernard Schutz, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, which is a fairly interesting book that I'm not sure how I ended up with it. I've ended up with it rather recently. But it was pretty clear from that what would happen is that there was a time when particles had so much energy that they'd build up into deuterium. They had enough protons and neutrons running around because of the radiation pressure. Since the particles all had that much energy, the neutrons lasted long enough to combine with protons. So you ended up with a lot of deuterium. And then occasionally those would turn into helium and even occasionally turn into lithium and stuff like that. But most of the matter that we see, I think possibly all of the matter that we see, was created in this time frame where there wasn't quite enough radiation pressure to blow everything up as soon as it got made. But also, there was still enough to produce these things. After a while, though, everything lost enough energy that they weren't able to produce any more. And so then all of a sudden, you just ended up with all that the helium and hydrogen that you're ever going to have sitting around in the universe. But right after that sort of quark soup phase, you no longer have any really interesting annihilation things happening, and you now have helium. Here's a list in my notes. Big Bang makes helium when electrons have enough energy to turn a proton into a neutron. Then the deuterium forms until the neutrinos stop having enough energy to break them up. And sometimes deuterium binds into helium, and that's where you get your stars from. And I think after that, the neutrinos no longer interact with anything. That's about as far as I understand.
Well, yeah, one of the greatest successes of the Big Bang model is predicting the primordial ratio of hydrogen to helium to lithium and maybe some trace elements. I'm not sure if it went beyond lithium, but the rate at which matter formed in the cooling of the universe was transpiring apparently predicts that ratio brilliantly. And so that was the crowning success of the Big Bang model. And then, of course, there's a little bit later after that, there's the transparency epoch where the electrons get captured around the atomic nuclei and we get, you know, stable hydrogen atoms with, you know, electron shells and in the helium atoms, and then so you've got this huge cloud of gases, and then as the universe expands beyond that point, the transparency point, which is where you get the fingerprint of the cosmic microwave background radiation, then it continues to condense and you get your stars, and then it continues the stellar evolution cycle where hydrogen is being made into helium inside stars, and then they explode. And I guess they can calculate pretty accurately how much helium has been made in stellar interiors and how many much heavier atoms got made from supernovas and that kind of thing, so that they have a really clear picture of how much of those elements must have existed at the time the cosmic microwave background radiation imprint was left in the universe.
And those are all these things that people are trying to model with these gravitational theories.
Yeah, but what I find really interesting is that general relativity works really well in that regime only if you postulate the existence of a hypothetical particle that we've never seen, the inflaton, and sort of tailor fit the behavior of the inflaton field with matter at that era. So in a way, it looks to me like general relativity needs that extra thing. And the nice thing about FR gravity was that some of those mathematics could allow you to create that inflation field without postulating a new particle. So that's really exciting to see.
Well, yeah, it is. I don't really like anything that you can't really see.
Yeah, like dark matter, right? I mean, we still haven't observed whatever the dark matter particle is, so we don't really know if it's a particle or if our theory of gravity just needs a different theory, right?
Yeah, that's the sort of thing that I just don't like seeing. Can we move on to cosmological perturbations? I think cosmological perturbations means that there's just... I think it just means that there are places that don't look exactly like every other place in the universe. They're just small nucleation sites of stuff turn into galaxies and stars and stuff like that. There might be more to it than that, because there are two different ways that they measure this. One is the cosmic microwave background, and the other is large-scale structure, which is basically looking at galaxies and seeing where the galaxies are, how much is over there, how much is over there, how much of is over there, and so forth and so on.
Well, that's one of the most amazing successes, I think, of modern astronomy, right, is because they've been actually able to make a direct relationship between the inhomogeneities in the cosmic microwave background radiation, and then predict from that the large-scale structure of the universe, because we could see where those condensation patches would lead to later era galaxy formations and things like that.
One thing that I was thinking is that there was a problem reconciling these two things, the cosmic microwave background and the large-scale structure. Is that at all true, or is that just me being crazy? The difference between the cosmological microwave background radiation and the galaxy surveys don't always seem to match up all the time, do they?
Well, I don't know the intricacies offhand. I'm not sure if that came up in the FR paper. It's been a little while since I read that for our talk. But there was also some discussion in there about the nature of the vacuum, and that comes into play when you're looking at your gravity theories. So there's like a fine tuning that goes on. You know, does your gravity theory naturally predict the coupling and the behaviors that are going to be required to get from the cosmic microwave background radiation to the large-scale structure? It's my understanding that astronomically we're doing a pretty good job of modeling general relativity with our understanding of cosmic evolution in order to find a good accord there. But I'm sure there's lots of room for improvement on that, and it's certainly a difficult thing for any gravity theory to predict.
Well, I mean, these are the things that they're trying to predict, right? So
I think there may be some remaining questions, though, on these cosmic voids. There's like these big bubbles of emptiness in the large-scale structure, and I'm not sure if they've modeled those to understand how the filaments and all of that kind of thing are evolving the way they are. There may be some questions there. I know there's been some discussion of looking at alternative theories of gravity and antimatter and the gravitational interaction of matter and of antimatter to try to understand what those voids are all about. I don't know how much theoretical foundation there is for that, though.
Found in my notes what the problem is that the microwave fluctuations, the density fluctuations as measured by the cosmic microwave background, the large-scale fluctuations, are suppressed compared to what you'd think they are from looking at the small-scale ideas, which come from the galaxy surveys. So the small-scale fluctuations seen in the galaxy surveys make you think you should have larger, large-scale fluctuations seen in the microwave background.
Oh, so it's too isotropic observationally, so we should see more.
I guess it's something like that. That's something we probably have to look into a little more to see what they really meant by that, because, I mean, this was half a paragraph in Section 4C in the Dynamics of Cosmological Perturbations. It's like half a paragraph, but it was interesting enough for me to note. I mean, that makes life even better, is that that gives you one more thing that if you're making your theory of gravity, that you'd like to be able to model. Not just what you see in the cosmic microwave background, not just what you see in the galaxy surveys. you'd like to be able to put them both together in a way that works, which apparently, as far as GR is concerned, they don't quite match up in those density.
I wonder if that's where if that's what I was thinking of in terms of the lambda cold dark matter model. Maybe without the lambda cold dark matter model, gravity alone won't give you on observed matter won't give you the correct density distribution and structure of the universe. So maybe that was one of his successes. Is that if you add dark matter, which is, you know, an unobserved, you know, we haven't been able to see anything like that in a lab, but if you add the dark matter, maybe that's where that large-scale structure starts to make sense.
Possibly. That might be one thing. Is it the cold dark matter or hot dark matter that predicts only 3 neutrinos? Do you know that?
Gosh, I don't know.
So one of the successes of dark matter is that it can figure out more or less the energy in the universe by the number of neutrinos that you have.
Huh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And apparently having more than 3, you'd have to have a lot more energy. The amount of energy that they see in these observations seems to be in accord with having 3 and only 3 neutrinos.
Hmm, okay. And we've observed all 3 of those, haven't we?
Yeah, we've seen all 3 of the neutrinos. All right, so that's cosmological stuff. So these are the things that people are trying to fit when they're making these theories, when they're fitting these constants, they're trying to look at these. But then you still have to go back, right? And you have to get into actual things.
Dynamics, yeah, like stellar dynamics.
You have to end up with stuff that we know works, right?
Right.
And the first one is obviously that it has to turn into Newtonian mechanics, which is possibly not as normal as, you know, it sounds, right? Because they're all branching off of general relativity. General relativity does collapse down into Newtonian mechanics, but sounded a little bit, reading this, like a lot of theories of gravity, people don't even bother checking them for a little while, and then they find out that, oh, whoops, if this was here, there'd be a fifth force. In fact, I think the whole idea of the fifth force is some place where the Newtonian limit doesn't actually give you Newtonian mechanics, and so you need a fifth force. I think we all understand basically what that means, is that you get nice stable orbits for planets around stars and moons around planets and stuff like that, and everybody's happy.
Well, right, because it's not that difficult to imagine theories where your gravitational radiation is much a higher rate than it should be, and so you'd have a decay of orbits over a short period of time and that kind of thing.
So we're lucky for most of these FR theories, for example, the Newtonian mechanics, they get to. Post-Newtonian experiments also work, and that's sort of in the weak field limit, right? The sort of things that are almost Newtonian but aren't quite, and things that just sort of bugged people, like the perihelion of Mercury. Like we were just talking about offline, we were talking about Vulcan, right? And
yeah, I love that. We might want to talk about that.
You want to talk about that?
No, go ahead. That's a good anecdote that people would enjoy.
Yeah, so people were taking all these observations of Mercury. They noticed they didn't quite work as far as Newtonian mechanics are concerned. The perihelion of Mercury processes where it shouldn't be processing, or processes more. And so they were wondering how that could happen. Somebody said, well, if we just postulate that there's another planet closer to the sun, then maybe that'll do it. And there are a lot of challenges to actually seeing that, to actually observing something that close to the sun. So they kind of figured out it would have to be at like 0.14 astronomical units, somewhere around a seventh of the orbital radius of the Earth. And people looked for it, and some guy in the 1860s actually saw it, or he saw what was probably a sunspot moving across the sun, and they calculated an orbit for it, how fast it was going, where it had to be, and all sorts of stuff. So for quite a while, people actually believed that there was a planet there. Now, there was lots of controversy. I'm not sure how much there was compared to things, but they had a sufficient amount of evidence and a sufficient reason and no other good explanation, so that you'd think that most people would think that, yeah, probably that there is a planet there. It's just really hard to see something that's, you know, right in front of the sun.
So that would make sense that you could make the perihelion of Mercury process faster if there was a planet inside its orbit, sort of dragging it around at a faster rate than normal. So that actually works out mathematically with the Newtonian mechanics?
As far as I understand it. So I didn't work it out myself, but from what I read, that worked out. And those guys, you know, in the 19th century, century, they were pretty good at doing those calculations already.
Nice.
So yeah, but it didn't work out. And especially what happened was there was this general relativity thing. And, in the weak field limit in general relativity, they actually explained that.
I love examples like that because it shows you how really smart people can find explanations that work but are wrong.
Well, yeah, and in this case it was, several, right? There was a theory guy and there was a astronomer guy. Actually, there were several astronomer guys and people saw different things. At one point, in fact, because it's fake, they thought there might be two planets because the data was inconsistent with there being just one planet because different observers got different stuff out of it. So, and then even after Einstein, for another 40 years or 50 years or so, people kept making observations and occasionally claiming that they saw Vulcan. But that's gone by the wayside. I don't think anybody thinks very much about Vulcan anymore.
And there's other post-Newtonian observations like frame dragging. Would that fall into that category? Like we see binary star systems and they have anomalies in their orbits. Is that another one of these second?
Well, I think everything like that. I think the ones that they're really looking for are things like the perihelion of Mercury and the bending of light around Jupiter. And there was one other one that's a classic test that I've forgotten.
Well, there was the bending of light around the sun, which I think was one of the major confirmations of general relativity early on.
Yeah.
That the light bent, I think, twice as much as it would have under Newtonian mechanics.
Yeah, so it bent twice as much with general relativity than it would with special relativity, I think it was. So if you use just special relativity, I think that's where you got that bending. With Newtonian mechanics, light, since it doesn't have any mass, doesn't bend at all.
Okay. I thought that if you took a Newtonian approach and said and it attributed the energy of a photon to its rest mass, that you could do the calculation and you'd end up with bending around the sun, but it would be half as much as it actually is observed to be, I think. I think I've seen that online.
Possibly something like that. But I think it sounded to me from other things that I've read that...
Because they didn't expect it to go straight, did they? Before general relativity, they still thought light would be deflected, didn't they?
I don't think so. Well, it's hard to say. So before special relativity, they might actually have thought it would be deflected. So they might not have had a long time to come to grips with those two ideas. But don't think that there's any reason for thinking light would be deflected by the sun if it's just electromagnetic radiation. Possibly there's something that would happen with the ether, but I think the whole point of the ether is putting it together so that it doesn't do that. The thing is that I don't think...
They didn't see that one coming, huh?
I don't think that was something that anybody really thought would happen. I think any other issue that people have with that are people trying to put patches on other theories to try to say that I don't have to believe your theory that predicted this, which, I mean, it might be perfectly valid, but I don't think it worked. I just think that, because a lot of this came up with the G4V, right, in the first episode.
Yeah, Carver Mead did an amazing job with this.
And it sounded like, even in that situation, in that particular discussion, it sounded like when Carver Mead was saying this, that if you put these things together with that vector potential, it didn't quite work. You got half that light bending.
Oh, no, I think what he did was he found Einstein's early work and he corrected it. And he said that if he had taken this step and finished the equation, then he would have gotten the right result.
Yeah, well, it sounded like he took two papers of Einstein's and put them together. And that first paper, and since I don't remember which either one was, but the first paper in time, the 1911 one, it sounded like he had made that prediction, and he was off.
Right, where he was off by a factor of two.
By a factor of two. And it sounded like, as far as Carver Mead said, Einstein never put those two things together. Instead, he just went on to the full theory of general relativity.
Right, but what I love about Carver Mead's talk about that is that he shows you how Einstein could have had the leap, I think by applying Green's function in there somehow, he could have had the leap and made the correct prediction if he had built his theory a little bit further down the line and ended up with a four-vector theory of gravitation.
Yeah, so probably. So yeah, that was Carver Mead's whole thing is that he said, look, if all you needed was to take these two things, do a little more work, and you get these classic experiments. Let's see, the third one is probably the spectral shift. So general relativity predicts that light emanating from a massive object is redshifted, and that's been shown for quite a long time. I think it's the 60s or something. Somebody showed that actually worked.
There was the Shapiro delay, I remember him talking about, you know, where I guess it takes a longer trajectory.
Yeah, that's a fourth one, is the Shapiro delay. And that's very important too. And I think there's also a geodesic effect on a gyroscope. And I guess that actually works in near-Earth orbit. So it's 8 seconds of arc per year, or 8 arc seconds per year, different from what you'd predict without general relativity.
Is that what the Gravity Probe B experiment was testing? It had that little gyroscope orbiting the Earth in a polar orbit?
I think so, yeah. So those are the weak field experiments that somebody has to match. And they show the FR theory is working a little bit here for those, but they doesn't spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense because, you know, it is built on general relativity. And so unless they push it so far that it breaks, it's gonna have the basic contours of making that kind of prediction.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think it's hard for FR theories not to get these two points right in the weak field. I think where we get to the places where FR theories start failing are for stable solutions. They had lots of ways that these things were unstable. I think the first one was specific to FR theories. That was the Dolgov-Kawasaki theory, which obviously is great because it's Kawasaki.
Really revs your engine to think about.
And that has something to do with this symmetry in the ground state has to be very highly symmetric. Ground state has to be very highly symmetric. Otherwise, in FR theories, you end up with what they're calling these matter-side instabilities, but it sounds to me like you just end up with spots where you get an infinite mass. Again, this is something that's not really important to talk about these things, because at least right now, it's only the FR theories that are showing this. It's only the FR theories that are showing this, and FR theories are more or less toy models, and they don't show up in all of the FR theories. It just gives you a form that you have to worry about when you're constructing these FR theories. And basically, that form is if you have a 1 over r term, you have to add in an r squared term. Now, there may be more than that, but that's what I saw in this paper. So apparently, the FR theories, they like r plus 1 over r. It's actually a constant over r. But they like that as a toy theory because, you know, it's easy to work with, probably. But again, you end up with these matter-side instabilities. And if you have these matter-side instabilities, you want to get rid of them because, you know, you just don't see a lot of infinitely massive things wandering around. And so you add in that R-squared term. It's not too interesting. It just gives you limits on these FR theories, and they might show up in other theories, but right now they don't.
And now, one of the things that I've always wondered about, I don't think that I've ever had a clear answer understanding of this, is when you've got a black hole, and it condenses down to a singularity. How does general relativity make sense of that? Because I thought that the force of gravity was proportional to like the density. So if you've got a singularity, then you've got an infinite density, then aren't you going to have like an infinite gravitational field?
That's sort of the thing you have to worry about. But it sort of depends on how quickly the density at a particular point is getting to infinity compared to how quickly the space is changing around that point.
Oh, yeah, because you're outside of that gravitational field looking at it. There's a time dilation, and so it's heading towards a singularity, I guess, and it doesn't actually reach it, right?
I'm trying to remember exactly what happens, and I don't. But there are probably removable sort of singularities that, even though it's technically infinitely dense, if you integrate over it, it's still okay. It's not infinitely massive. It's just infinitely dense at that point.
Okay.
Which may not even have to be infinitely dense in the real world. It might just have to be very, very dense. So it just depends on how quickly that density is changing, whether or not you can integrate over it or not. And this is just sort of a topic that has to do with integrations. I'm not sure if it's really possible to have anything that's truly infinite. But anytime you're dealing with a discontinuity in calculus, if it changes around that discontinuity fast enough, your integral is still finite.
Okay.
It's just how quickly it's getting to that infinite amount at that infinitesimally small spot. I guess that's another way to think about it, is it's at that infinitesimally small spot that you have that infinite density. So when you actually add that little bit up, you're infinity times a zero, basically.
Right. Oh, I see. Okay. So it kind of renormalizes itself by virtue of being just this, you know, incredibly tiny speck.
That's right. So it's just on the edge of being okay.
Right.
You don't really like infinities in the real world, but for this particular case, it's not something that is scary or crazy because it's an infinity at an infinitesimally small spot. So it's okay.
I've been under the false impression that in that case, general relativity breaks down, but that doesn't seem to be the case because mathematically you can work it out, and it's
It's probably okay. You don't need to get into anything like renormalization or anything like that. It's not as bad a discontinuity as they have. It's not that bad a singularity as they have with the charge of the electron, which is a worse problem. And of course, then they invent renormalization and they get rid of it. So we're all okay. There are other places where you still can't get rid of it, even with the renormalization stuff. So,
oh, shit.
Yeah, you don't want to play around with infinity if you don't have to. Let's see. What other things did we have to worry about? You had to produce stable de Sitter solutions, which are basically these solutions that are very flat space-times that are dominated by the cosmological constant or by a dark energy or something like that. This is where the universe is supposed to end up, basically, is how I understand it. There's a stability in the first loop in quantum gravity. I'm not sure why that's something you really, really need, except you eventually want a quantum gravity. And I think that first loop just means, you know, when you're doing these quantum gravity things, you're not dealing with quantum mechanics. You're dealing with the standard model, something that's a lot like quantum electrodynamics, right? And in that case, you have these self-interaction terms. So what I guess this is saying is that the self-interaction of a graviton should not blow everything up, which is perfectly reasonable. But of course, then you have more loops. But I mean, at least the first one should be okay. I don't know why the second one shouldn't be, but at least the first one should.
Well, I guess it's a good start, at least.
That's right. Okay, and stability in the face of inhomogeneous and isotropic perturbations, which is basically means you should be able to end up with nice galaxies and things like that that don't blow up. And black holes should nucleate correctly and, again, not blow everything up.
Or I guess collapse too fast either. You don't want a galaxy that's going to implode on itself and emit a burst of gravitational radiation as it collapses into a singularity.
And so those are those weak field limits.
And the black hole nucleation, just to be clear, is that what we were talking about, like the collapse process of a star, as it forms into a black hole? Is that what nucleation is, when it drops below the event horizon? And
I don't see it in my notes, I'm sad to say. I've got a couple of things here about black holes, but they don't seem to be that useful. All the things I have about black holes are in the gravity wave section.
Okay.
Let's see, it says that spherically symmetric black holes seem to be perfectly okay. Perturbed black holes are almost okay. And then if you start getting things spinning around, actually, I think if you get things spinning around, you get extra kind of black hole-y things with the FR gravities. There are more solutions that are okay than with a regular gravity.
The black hole formation is actually a pretty complex puzzle because, you know, you've got the collapse process where it has to overcome the repulsive aspect of the strong nuclear force, and then I guess you've got a kind of quark gluon plasma, and it's got to overcome the pressure and the heat and everything of that extremely dense, you know, plasma state of matter, and it's got to keep collapsing. You've got to be forcing your quarks closer and closer together. It's an interesting problem.
It's nice that your black holes actually work right, I guess.
Yeah.
Is the way to say it. And I guess those are those weak field limits. So these are things that you should have and aren't too strange, right? But the next thing on my list is pretty strange, and it's these ghost fields.
Now, ghost fields has the sound of something which isn't real.
Well, yeah, it's something that they don't like in the theory. So I think this is just something that shows up in these theories sometimes. A poor, unfortunate theory of gravity will get a ghost field. They don't really, really like it. And in these cases, these basically massive fields. So they're fields of mass that are non-unitary, which is bad. But the big thing is they have this negative norm, which means that they're sort of repulsive. you don't want anything in your theory that basically gives you a negative mass. Did we talk about negative? We did talk about negative mass in a previous episode. Obviously, if you observe negative mass, then maybe this isn't such a big deal anymore.
Oh, okay.
But right now, we haven't observed these negative masses, so maybe then it will be. Now, I'm not sure. Maybe there's some more to it about that people don't like about it. But, you know, even here, they didn't talk too much about the ghost fields very much, other than to say that, you know, if the second derivative of this FR function, if that second derivative of that is greater than zero, then you don't have to worry about it. You get a field. You do get the field, but you don't get a ghost field, and then you get something kind of like your dark energy. But if your F double prime is less than zero, then you get something that is not nice.
Yeah, I'm seeing on a WikiLeaks page, or I'm sorry, on a I've got
WikiLeaks. Oh, WikiLeaks.
On a Wikipedia page. That
so they finally put that stuff from Area 51 up there, right?
Oh, I would love that. Oh my God, that'd be the greatest.
Anyways.
On the Wikipedia page, they're saying that that ghost fields can lead to a superluminal propagation of information and acausal events and things like that. So I think that your reality really does seem to unravel if you get these babies in your physical universe.
Okay, well, then they're even worse than I thought. All right, so you don't want those. So you don't want any of these ghost fields in there. And this is really technical. The next one is, it should admit a well-posed Cauchy problem. Which basically means that it should give you a fairly nice differential equation and that you actually understand how to work. It's not too annoying a thing to say. It's just that...
No, this has to do with the topology of space-time, right? Like, it's got to satisfy... Like, the way that space-time curves, it has to satisfy certain boundary conditions, you know, and I think that has to do with the hypersurface where you've got... the distortion of the hyperplane, and it's got to have a certain mathematical relationship that somehow works out to one. So you get these really clean answers, right?
Yeah. In the end, your solutions and your problem has to have solutions that you can actually use, right? I mean, there probably is something interesting physically in there, but...
Okay, well, all right.
Yeah, I mean, I wish there was something more, but while I was reading that section, it just did not really seem to me like there was a major physical content in there. It sounded a lot like we're just worrying about what do these solutions look like? Do they kind of look nice or not?
But I think nice might refer to the solutions to the partial differential equations have to satisfy these specific conditions, and then it gets into this kind of hairy geometry and manifold kind of talk where it goes into the nature of how you solve for these geometrical problems on a manifold.
And then finally it has to give a reasonable theory of gravity waves, right?
Yep.
And so if you're going to get these gravity waves, they should not be crazy-looking gravity waves. They should do the sort of things that we want them to do.
Yeah, and we've got our first experimental detection of gravity waves now, so we know that those babies are real. We know that general relativity is reasonably close on its magnitude and that kind of thing. And what I loved about the G4V theory was that it predicts... a very, very similar like magnitude and signature, but its polarization is like 90 degrees different than the general relativity prediction, and that's something that we can't distinguish between we can't distinguish yet from reality because we haven't observed the polarization of a gravity wave yet. So I'm really excited to see how that turns out. That's my favorite horse race right now.
Awesome. Okay. Were there any other interesting things that you were thinking about from this thing?
Well, one of the things, this is the only thing that really comes to mind while I was thinking about this, is that it seems like it's such an early stage of finding the loose ends of observational deviations from general relativity that it would be really nice to have more explicit data on everything from the exact magnitude of dark energy and how it works over different scales of distance, that it would be nice to have things like the polarization of gravity waves to test. Gravitation is still, you know, such a weak force, and it's so difficult to observe deviations from general relativity that we won't really have a good data set to say that general relativity is wrong or to what degree. And so it'd be nice to really have the mathematical parameters of this is what we need, you know.
I think as far as those sort of mathematical things are concerned, you know, getting better and better data is something that we just need to do, and it just takes a lot of time, especially in this particular case. I mean, unless we can get people who are really, really, really clever and can coax out these things in a laboratory, then, you know, you're just going to have to wait until people figure out new ways to test it with things that are there or actually see things that are from earlier and earlier times.
And also see the formation of, not the formation necessarily, but that's one of them, but be able to see when black holes collide with other black holes or with neutron stars, and if we can study the gravitational wave signatures from those events with higher precision, then we'll get a better idea of what's really happening in that evolving system. Because apparently you can tease out a lot of data about what's happening inside the event horizon. If you can get a good gravity wave signature of high resolution, you know. So that's a really exciting realm of physics, is these laser interferometer gravitational observatories.
Yeah, so yeah, lots and lots of new experiments will add lots and lots of detail to these things. It'll be a lot of fun to see what happens in the future. All right, well, I think that's all I really want to talk about with this. I think this is a really good start to whatever we look at next, because it looks like there are also plenty of other gravitational theories that we can look at. I really just wanted to do this to make sure that we had a reasonably clear idea about what these theories need to be able to do and what these things actually are. And obviously there are a couple of things here we need to look into a little more as well. Just because we really don't seem to understand them very well.
Well, you did such a nice job enumerating them, though, and that opens up realms for new investigation. But maybe you could put a link to this outline up on the podcast so that people can have that. I've got this thing printed out, and I've got it on my wall just so that I can, as a reference for, you know, things that I still need to brush up on and for just to check various theories that you come across online.
I'll try to put that in the show notes to see how that actually works out. Also, if you could, from the last one that we put out, if you could go ahead and hit that on the Reddit. I noticed that you had a much longer description than I did on episode 4, whatever was the last one that I finished editing. If you could take your description and just put that in a comment on the Reddit, then maybe that'll help some people out there, and maybe more people will actually see it.
Sounds great.
And obviously, if you're listening to this, why don't you visit our subreddit, which is at www.reddit.com/r/physicsfm. All right. We also have a blog thing at www.physicsfm.com. Hopefully there's a link there for Physics Frontiers. And let's see, any other interesting places to go? Obviously, we're hosted on Podomatic.
On Podomatic, right. I'm also working on a Facebook page so that everybody can connect to us there.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So hopefully by the time this comes out, which is probably in about 5 months at this rate, all this stuff will be ready for anybody who's listening to this. All right.
Sounds great.
Okay. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you, Jim.